Hello, welcome to the House Einstein podcast. My name is Osman, and I am the founder of House Einstein, and with me is Hamish Crabb.
Hello, hello. I'm Hamish, and I help keep the podcast, I help keep the brokerage running smoothly.
Among many, many other things. And our mission in this podcast, if this is your first time listening, is to help you make a smarter real estate decision. House Einstein is a little brokerage based in Boulder, but with a footprint that goes to Denver and all the way up to Fort Collins. We cover a lot of the Front Range, and we also have started to do business in the mountains, including Frisco, Breckenridge, Winter Park, and we represent buyers and sellers. But if you are not a client of our brokerage, then this podcast is entertainment. It is not spiritual advice. It's not real estate advice. It's not financial advice. If you are a client of our brokerage, please contact the agent that represents you for advice on your unique specific situation. Do not take as gospel what we say. We really want to help you do the best in your purchase or sale process. And the best way to do that is if you just reach out to us rather than relying on our podcasts. We are here to serve you. The podcast is an adjunct to our primary activities, which is helping people buy and sell real estate.
Well said.
Okay. That's the disclaimer, a little bio, our mission. And if this is your first time here, scoot on over to houseeinstein.com. You can sign up for our newsletter. You can see some of our thoughts on recent sales. It's a great way to get to know us. And if you're thinking about buying or selling, don't hesitate to reach out. You will find us at houseeinstein.com. And with that said, let's go through our topics du jour. Here's what we're going to be talking about on this podcast. We're going to discuss market conditions. We're going to talk about the sale of the week. We're going to touch on some recent news specific to the Boulder market, including big redevelopment projects, all very close to each other. And we're going to talk about Deion Sanders and his recent foray into looking at homes again. Clearly, his first choice a year ago was a bad choice. I wonder who could have told you that. And then one of the things we're going to talk about in this podcast that you don't often hear about from real estate agents is whether you should hire your friends. We're going to talk about the pros. We're going to talk about the cons. And then we're going to tell you something that you probably don't know. And that's how to fire your realtor. Tell me something I don't know is becoming a regular segment on the podcast. And firing your realtor or your real estate agent, if they're not a realtor, is not something that is easily done. So we're going to go into what that looks like. And then we're going to talk a little bit about one of the unintended consequences of the large increase in values that many people probably have not thought about, the large increase, the appreciation and values for real estate in Colorado. What happens now? And a lot of people are fixated on taxes. It does relate to taxes. We're going to talk about one of those second or third order effects that people often don't think about when it comes to enjoying real estate appreciation. And then we'll wrap it up with a little closing thoughts.
Brilliant.
How's that sound, Hamish?
It sounds like a great podcast that I'm excited for us to dive into.
Hopefully it's a podcast that we ourselves would listen to.
I mean, I would. I'm also in it, so you get that kind of 50-50 out of it.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. It is strange to think about listening to our own podcast, but maybe 20 years from now, we'll sit down by the fire with our cocktails and fire roaring, and we'll just, like old-timey, we'll just put on the podcast for old time's sake.
Like I genuinely think, you know, if I have children or something, having this cache of content of me, like a living kind of personality of me, is going to be fantastic for them at some point.
I think that too. And for yourself, honestly, that's one of the reasons why I personally put together videos of our vacations. Some of these are on my YouTube, my personal YouTube channel. This is not our business YouTube. I just want to have that for a memory because video is so compelling, and all of the skills that you and I have learned in video production also apply to other forms of content creation. And so it's kind of fun and interesting to put together these travel videos. But for those listening, I mean, you're certainly welcome to go join the massive number of subscribers I have on my personal YouTube. But I understand that that's not our business. Our business is helping people be smart about their real estate decisions. And I guess you could learn a little bit about me by digging into my personal YouTube channel.
Nothing to hide.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing to hide. Okay, so let's start off at the top. Where are we with this podcast? I've scrolled too far up. Okay, there we go. Market conditions. All right, we're going to do this live. I'm not going to show you my screen because that might piss off the MLS. But let's talk about three things. Let's talk about the percentage of homes currently under contract. And then let's talk about the difference in the first 3 weeks of the year. Today is the last month of January, but unfortunately, the data is not instantaneous with real estate. The closest I feel comfortable to trusting data from real estate agents is 1 week out. So actual data from January, I feel comfortable digging into after January 7th. February. After February 7th, I feel comfortable digging into January's data. And before that time, I don't trust it. It's just not enough information. The MLS takes a few days to catch up, and that's mostly driven by agents that take their time updating the MLS. So let's talk about percentage under contract. So with respect to all listings, let's start there when we drill down. And we're going to do attached and detached houses. So this means townhomes and condos and single-family houses in Boulder County. Across the entire county of Boulder, what percentage are under contract? Hamish, do you want to take a guess?
Oh, you know, I have the stats, but I never did the division on them. Let me see if I can do some quick
math. No cheating. I'm doing it. I'm doing it right now. So this is total number of listings on the market right now, whether they're under contract or not. These are townhomes, condos, single-family houses. The number is 767. And then when you ask, well, what number of those 767 are actually under contract? That is 279. So 279 over, what was that other number, Hamish? Seven something. Yeah. Getting old. Let's get that number again. 767. Oh, it's a jet. Okay. 279 over 7.
It's a jet.
767 minus 1. That's 36% of the market. We don't need a minus one. It's just 36%. 36.3% of the market is currently under contract, which at the peak of March 2022, we were seeing more like 60% of the market was almost instantly under contract. So what does that mean? It means you have two-thirds of the market that is available for you to potentially put an offer on. That's pretty good for buyers going into February. Hmm. And when we look at the difference between... Now, this is where things start to get nuanced, and we can drill down the rabbit hole all the way down to the street level, but let's just drill down to the difference between single-family houses and attached dwellings. So for single-family houses, there currently are 527, and of those 527, 184 are under contract. So 184... over 527, let's do the math together, 34.9%. So really not that different. I would have expected to see more, and the market has been hovering around 50% for so long. So this is not quite a buyer's market, but it finally has some selection. And what we're seeing in the marketplace on the what I'm seeing when my buyers look at things is that the homes that are priced right, that are updated, in the good locations, they are going under contract almost immediately, and in some cases, rare cases, are attracting more than one offer. Sometimes agents who don't do what we do, these are agents that keep the data in their pocket, they will not tell their listing, their seller that the market is... They don't really show the seller true market conditions. Instead, what they do is they just price it low, especially if the seller has a low expectation of value. Like the seller may be going on Zillow, or maybe they're totally blind. They just think, oh, wow, my house is worth, maybe it's worth $750. Mr. Listing Agent, I don't really know. And when you hear that with and you tell your agent that, and they're not a reputable agent, they're not an agent with much integrity, they say, oh, wow, if they know it's worth $900, they're going to price it really low, like at $800, because they know that if they price it intentionally low, they're likely to get multiple offers.
And which looks great.
which looks great. You now run around telling everyone that your agent's so smart, they got you multiple offers, and it's sold very quickly. If they're really good, they use multiple offers against each other to tighten up the contract that is the winning contract. They reduce inspection periods, reduce the scope of inspection, waive all sorts of things like due diligence docs or association docs, and we'll talk about that in another podcast from a recent deal. So there are all sorts of reasons to price it intentionally low, but sometimes it also means leaving money on the table. So when you hear in your social circles how proud somebody is of the fact that their agent got multiple offers, just keep in mind that there's a really good chance they priced it low. And it doesn't mean that they necessarily are going to leave money on the table. There is a chance that they actually drive that price up above where it would have landed if they priced it high to begin with. But it's a risk that we prefer our clients to take consciously. And yeah. I know for a fact, based on conversations with sellers, that they were not told that that was the strategy. The listing agent has that strategy because they want to be done with this listing as fast as possible. And I get it. It sucks when we have a listing that goes 6-9 months. That's painful. But the decisions should always be conscious. They should always be on the table and openly discussed with your agent. They should not be your agent's executing a strategy you didn't know about.
That's so, right. And when we're doing our listing consultations with clients, you know, we mention the goal is to maximize sale price while minimizing time on market, right? It's not, we try to strike that balance versus just getting it out there and underpricing it so much so that you get the multiple offers.
Price is arguably the most important component of an intelligent marketing strategy. It's not the only one. Professional photography, videography, correcting the obvious visible defects in the home, maybe even updating the home because you know it has higher potential. If you were to remodel a kitchen, that was a client question today. There are all sorts of things you can do to improve the marketability of a home. Price is one really important component, and our approach is always price it initially when we sign the listing agreement and then price it again the week we go active when we look very closely at its competitors and make sure we're priced in a way that makes sense with the competition currently on the market. And if there's a home that's radically low, well, we might want to wait a week or two. If somebody has intentionally underpriced a competitor, then you may want to wait till that's gone. And if a home is overpriced, well, now you can use that home also to help position your listing in the competitive landscape. You can use that home to sell yours. And we've, at the last minute, moved pricing $50,000 or more either way. And that's based on seeing the competition. So that's the nutshell of be careful with bidding wars and what you hear from your friend that might be selling a home. And it's not necessarily a sign of a intentional strategy. And if you hear they got like 20 offers, it's really not a sign of an intentional strategy. Yeah. Because you can't negotiate effectively with more than 3 or 4 offers. And even that's complicated. So typically your job when you're drumming up multiple offers is to encourage people to submit who are actually going to be competitive, and people that are not going to be competitive, that aren't going to be able to hit even the lowest benchmark, save their time. Like if they're 100,000 off where most of the top offers are landing, why are you encouraging yet another offer? So because you're supposed to go through all these offers, by the way, and they're what, 17 or 18 pages, at least here in Colorado, that's how many pages these contracts are. And you're supposed to do this in like a 24-hour period? Probably not, is what you're getting is poor service from your agent.
And it started... Okay. It doesn't reflect
well. No, go ahead. Sorry, Hamish.
It just doesn't reflect well, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we see it. We know what's going on, and I wish the public would know what's going on. And the biggest problem with the real estate business is that people, in the absence of solid benchmark performance metrics to choose who is representing them, they make their decisions based on the fact that this agent is hanging their license with a brokerage that looks shiny, the shiny wrapper brokerage. Mm-hmm. The agent could be brand new in the industry and or 2 years in the industry and have no clue what they're doing, have done like a handful of transactions, but because their name is now under a Compass or Remax or Coldwell Banker or whatever, that brand name makes you feel like, oh, well, they must know what they're doing. And the vast majority of people don't even understand that agents are independent contractors. And most of these brokerages will take you if you can fog a mirror. So
pretty much, yeah. And pay the office fees.
And this topic will dovetail with what we're going to talk about later, how to fire your agent, and also the pros and cons of choosing your friend as an agent, which often was what people do, is they just choose someone they trust. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with choosing someone you trust, but they may not have your best interest in mind or even be remotely competent in the industry. And now, Hamish, that you've have a few years under your belt, you see the incompetence, and we have conversations about it when we represent the other side and we're dealing with somebody who's doing things in such a bizarre way or just missing the most basic functions of due diligence for their client.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting to be able to be in a position of, I guess, this much competency so quickly. I mean, of course, I'm exposed to so much, and I've gotten a bunch of experience, but we were at this event earlier last week, and I was eavesdropping a conversation between a few agents, and I think they were a little bit more experienced and kind of on the higher end, and all of their gripes, they were complaining about the same thing, incompetent agents, and all of their gripes I totally understood, and I knew that I wouldn't be making them because of the experience that we have here. So it was just really cool hearing somebody complain and then knowing that I was good from that, and also I could see where they're coming from too and had experience with these I guess less experienced agents.
Well, you have seen more deals in 1 year than the typical agent sees in five.
Yeah.
And that's because you're also seeing all these other deals, not just my deals, but the deals from the other agents on board. And I also feel like you have a beginner's mind when it comes to a lot of things, and you're not afraid to ask questions. Mm-hmm. And I also maybe am not quite as, I don't know, unapproachable as a boss. Like, I hopefully have an environment yeah. where you can actually ask these questions and I don't belittle the question, even if it's a so-called dumb question, because there are no dumb questions.
Yeah.
And I'd rather you ask these questions than you don't. And what appears frequently is just unbelievable behavior.
And we're not, you know, you're not inexperienced as well. So you kind of know what's up, and I'm able to ask questions that you know how to answer as well. Imagine if you also had 2 years of experience, you know.
Well, what's funny, Hamish, is I don't always have the answer. Mm-hmm. That's the other very interesting thing about being a real estate agent, is it's constantly an opportunity to learn. Like, the depth of knowledge that you have that you can potentially gain year after year after year, if you stay in this industry, is amazing. And mm-hmm. I quite arrogantly thought when I got into this business, a house is a house. What do I need to know about anything? And I've lived in houses my whole life. It turns out the arrogance of that idea is just laughable now that I'm 20 years into this and still realize how little I know.
Yeah. Well,
all right, let's keep going with the data, huh? Mm-hmm. All right, next data point that I promised, which was, all right, so how did the first 3 weeks of the year compare with last year? And by the way, we could, again, do this data for the city. We could do this for Denver. We could do it for Louisville, Lafayette, Longmont. We just don't want to turn this into a five-hour podcast, that data analysis. I just want to give you some taste of what's happening as a listener at the broad market level. So for the first 3 weeks of the year, let's go back to – no, let's leave it as just single-family houses. Okay. And let's see how many houses sold last year in Boulder County. From January 1st through January 21st, right? The first 3 weeks of the year, because that should be accurate at this point. And last year, those first 21 days, we sold, well, realtors sold, real estate agents sold 50 houses in Boulder County. These are single family houses. And this year, we are looking at 61. So 61 over 50 minus 1, that's a 22% increase in sales volume year over year for the first 3 weeks of the year. And that's a pretty optimistic sign that this year is off to solid footing compared to last year. I like to see 3 months of data, even with a data – ooh, I just bumped the microphone. even with a data set as large as Boulder County, I really like to see a few months, but – for it to be actionable information, we really need that information to get to you faster. So early indications are for a stronger year.
Yeah.
And that's what we're seeing.
And there's the whole argument too, right? Once you get so granular, you can't really predict a trend. I was just looking at this week's stats, you know, on their own, and the larger picture isn't really encapsulated there, so the data is a little bit off of what we've been seeing over the past the few weeks beforehand. But it's also still in line. I mean, there's still more under contract, and there's still more things happening, but there's a little less sold. So,
well, I think. Well, actually, I'm going to ask you, explain what you mean when things get so granular.
Well, yeah, if I look at like how today performed versus yesterday, and I saw, okay, well, today was far worse than yesterday, so therefore the market is now on a downturn. That's I'm looking too small, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, that's one lens of granularity, mm-hmm. right? Time. But the other lens of granularity is specificity when it comes to the real estate search. And this is why I keep telling my clients, and you've heard me say it many times, let's do an analysis specific to what you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
Let's look at what's sold in the last 12 months. After we've dialed it in, you want to spend whatever the number is, $1.5 million to $2 million, and you want to buy in the city of Boulder. Well, first, you're going to be disappointed in what your options are, because Boulder real estate has gone so high that really the turnkey houses are often $3 million and up. But between the $1.5 and $2 million range, let's look at what's sold in the last 12 months. Because if you apply that same lens to Lafayette or to other parts of Boulder County, you're going to see dramatically different market conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And so the city of Boulder is its own thing.
Yeah, locale.
West of Broadway is its own thing. Newlands and Mapleton Hill are radically different. Trailhead, which is just west of Newlands, radically different. And rarely traded. So now you also are looking at a problem with really small samples. So all of that is meant to say that if you are specifically thinking about buying or selling, you can look at all the broad market data you want, but it's not actually relevant to what you're doing. What's actionable is stuff down to the street level. And for that, you need somebody who can show you the data. And if you're our client, I'm happy to do that. If you're not mm-hmm. our client, well, ask your agent if they can do that for you. And when they wave their hands and can't do it, you know who to call. That's a little arrogant, I suppose. Well, but look. It's just reality that they just don't do this level of analysis and this level of work. I wish they did, but that's our competitive advantage, is we'll show you the data. Mm-hmm. All right. All right, so that's it. We've talked about market conditions. Let's move on to the sale of the week, 2818 13th Street. So as a reminder, we cannot discuss active listings in much detail. We can't certainly share our honest opinion about active listings in a vehicle like this podcast that is open to the public. We do discuss active listings critically in our monthly newsletter, Fresh Listings. If you're buying or selling, that doesn't come out often enough for that to be actionable, but at least it'll give you a flavor of how we think and look at sold listings, how we analyze them. How we think about active listings and how we analyze them. But when it comes to sold listings, we can discuss them here on the pod. So let's jump into it. 2818 13th Street. Boy, that's a mouthful. 2818 13th Street in our lovely city, the city of Boulder. So this particular house, I closed the window. Let me open it again. I opened up the home that Dion is potentially buying. Okay.
That's later in the pod.
That is later in the pod. All right, here we go. 2818 13th Street. It's a 50s-era ranch that at some point was extensively remodeled, and we could pull up the permit history. But judging just by the architecture, it's very likely that the home was remodeled right before compatible development ordinances locked it down, because there's no articulating wall. It's just a giant box. It's like they took the ranch-style house. They may have blown out the back to make it a little bit broader of a footprint, and then they just built straight up. So you have a cardboard box shaped.
It reminds me a little bit of like a newer, I don't want to, a kind of Denver Square, but less exciting.
I mean, it's square. I don't really see square, I guess. Common. Yeah. They took That's away the it. Garage. They built a carport. It has a ramp out the front, and the second story is wrapped in what's very likely to be ephes. And you can't really tell it's ephes unless you actually do an investigation to see if it's ephes. Ephes stands for exterior finish insulation system. It is a foam board that's glued to the house. It adds R value. One of the telltale signs are if you see a lot of detail work around windows in the ephes itself or in the finish itself. That is often a sign of ephes. You can knock on it and it sounds a little hollow. That's often a sign of ephes. But the real way to tell for sure is by drilling out a core sample. EFIS, great idea, but in practice, it has it requires a high degree of maintenance. And then there, if it has been maintained well, it's a fantastic product. If it was installed right, maintained right. But I've negotiated six-figure concessions for EFIS when it was not addressed, when it was not maintained, when there were when moisture got behind the foam board, and now you've got mold, you've got the whole exterior needs to be stripped. It can be really expensive. Our entire office complex, millions of dollars of settlement over the lawsuit from the original builder over poorly installed EFIS. But this particular house, I don't know if it's EFIS or not, but it hit the market at a really strange time. So let's jump in first with location. I started talking about the exterior potential exterior finish before I even talked about location. So this location is really interesting in that it is kitty corner to the Ideal Market Complex. And the Ideal Market Complex is North Boulder's retail home. It's where you'll find coffee shops, liquor store, you'll find Sweet Cow. You'll find a great restaurants like Santos. It is really the heart of shopping for North Boulder residents, and this is kitty corner to that. The corner is a little busy. Balsam and 13th is busy. It gets traffic. It's constantly happening. It's also only a couple of blocks south of access to one of my favorite parts of North Boulder, the Growing Gardens Community Garden Center and facilities. It's really not a horrible spot, although it's going to be a busy spot. Mm-hmm. And the home itself, as it's listed, features 3,400 square feet, all of which is finished, and none of which is in the basement. So it says it has zero basement. So that, I guess, is slab on grade. Those are one of those things that often make me wonder if it's a listing mistake, because these 50-era houses mostly were built with a basement. I have seen a couple that are slab on grade, including one that has a tensioned slab, but really uncommon for this era to not have a crawl space, unless you happen to be right in the middle of a flood zone. But even the homes in the flood zones usually have crawl spaces. So I'd be surprised if that's not a listing mistake. But 3,400 square feet, six bedrooms, six bath. You got a carport. It's listed as zero spaces, but I'm pretty sure there's a space in that carport. It should have been one space in the carport. And listing mistakes are not uncommon, by the way. It's just, I don't know why data entry is hard, but data entry is hard. Okay. It shouldn't be, but sometimes it is. All right. When you look at the photos and you flip through this house, you see finishes that are probably dating back to when the second story was installed. Mm-hmm. And they're all very inexpensive finishes. Nothing fancy, all dated, but durable. And that should come as no surprise, because the previous occupant was apparently a group home. And they were using all six bedrooms, one of which is non-conforming. Don't know what the group home was for. It doesn't really matter. But the house itself needs a complete interior remodel. It all dates from that time period. And there's actually a secondary structure in the back that looks like it was the original garage. I'm not entirely sure what happened, but one of the things that you really want to do with when you see what looks like a garage that's been converted into studio space and workshop space, maybe home offices, is to look into the permit history, because it may not be a legitimate use. And if you were to go and try to do something with this house and actually pull a permit, you can run into a lot of trouble. So it's another due diligence checkpoint. But let's look at what happened with this listing. It hit the market in November, at the end of November, right after Thanksgiving, which has to be the worst possible time to list a home. And I tell my clients the same thing. Like, no one's really home shopping other than the deep bargain hunters at this time of year. And those people tend to be really aggressive on their initial offer. And if anything comes up on inspection, they tend to hammer you again, because they're totally unattached. It's all about the price. And you can expect to deal with very few showings. And if you get an offer, you can expect to deal with pretty low offers. This particular house was on the market 3 weeks at 1.95, and it eventually sold for $1,876,200, which is a rather unusual number, which by itself suggests there was some haggling going on, right? Like, how do you end up with that number? But it's a respectable 3.8% below list price. So, you know, it actually isn't bad from a negotiation standpoint. to get to that point. But then for some reason, and it's not disclosed what that reason was, the buyer was able to negotiate an additional $46,000, $46,500, out of the seller. And it just said closing costs, but what closing costs are there when you're paying cash? That's a cash deal, yet there's $46,500 in closing costs? I don't think so.
That's quite
hefty. I think that's an inspection concession, almost certainly, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the story of this listing. It sold for $553 a square. That does not include the $46,000 additional concession. When you add that in, it's even deeper of a discount. It doesn't really matter. It's not a horrible discount. They got, I think, lucky. And we'll see what the use is of this house. Boulder is no longer enforcing, or hasn't been for a long time, housing occupancy limits. And this place was probably already in violation of those anyway, for a long time. So the neighbors are used to it being overoccupied. I think it's actually a very interesting investment, given what, I don't want to call them group homes, but given what homes that appeal to people that want to live together, these are often young professionals, students, co-ops, I could add cults. who wants to live with five
it's
other
Boulder
people?
After all.
Well, yeah, it is Boulder after all. It's interesting to see. I don't know who the buyer is. It could easily be another entity, a organization that's part of the city of Boulder, or another group home type provider. Boulder is filled with nonprofits that serve all sorts of communities, homelessness, addictions. It could be any of those things. So we will find out what happens with this if we keep an eye on it. But that's the story of 2818 13th Street. And if I were doing anything different with this listing, I would have waited till mid-January right now to list it. I think it was a mistake to list it at that time of year. But it also is sort of a really ugly box on a box. You know, I'm not offending the LLC that sold it or the people that bought it, but it, you know, that's one of the reasons compatible development was passed, so people don't just maximize square footage and build these giant boxes that are ugly and dominate the neighborhood, because that's what you design when you just want the maximum number of bedrooms and baths and square footage.
Yeah.
And so at the time, yeah.
Okay. So there's two things on this one. You mentioned the ramp into it, and then the bathroom. Well, one of the bathrooms, I'm assuming the main level, is just ADA handled to the extreme. So I'm curious, kind of, too, what the use was, and then the tax assessment. I'm looking on Realtor.com, but it looks massive, and I wonder if that ties into the topic we might hit later on.
Well, the increase in taxes definitely is going to tie in. Everyone in Boulder is seeing a huge increase.
Yeah, so the assessment is the assessed value, or is that what they're being levied? At least on Realtor.com, because I'm a total assessment.
There are two things.
Yeah.
There's the assessed value,
mm-hmm.
and then there's a different number that is based on the mill rate, which is, it's just a multiplier.
Right.
That it's a ratio that you multiply by, and it there are multiple pieces that add up to the mill rate based on location. But at the end of the day, what spits out is taxes due.
Mm-hmm.
And taxes is an entirely different topic, and I also feel like it's not the right topic for this podcast.
Tread lightly topic.
Complex it can get.
Yeah.
But my understanding is final taxes are still not set for last year because of what's going on in the legislature, and there's a bunch of money that people should be getting back, and it's sort of it's going to be a political mess once people realize how much their taxes are going to go up.
Yeah. Final thing. Just speaking to when you're saying listing in November, you should check it out on Street View. There's pictures from June 2023, and it looks so much more gorgeous.
Really?
Yeah, it's just lush. It's covered in green. You know, all the neighborhoods look fantastic, and it just really changes.
I mean, that's another reason to list. So our general recommendation for listing, if you want to maximize your sale price, is to list it in mid-March to early April. When the landscaping starts to wake up, the market also starts to wake up, but you don't have as much leeway to test the market with price at that time of year. I mean, you really should never be testing the market with price, but if you feel like you want to test the market, it's better to do it in the first quarter than it is in the second, and forget about it in the third or fourth. You're just inviting a really long listing period.
Truly.
Let's move on. with some real estate news that might be of interest to you if you are a buyer or seller here in Boulder or thinking about moving to Boulder. The first one is the redevelopment of the Millennium Harvest House. Now, this particular building, even though it's horrifically ugly, was home to an infamous event that occurred for many years in Boulder called the Friday Afternoon Club. And the Friday Afternoon Club at this particular hotel was the bee's knees of debauchery and hookup culture and God knows what was going on here in the 80s. But my friends that lived in Boulder that are significantly older than I am talk about it with such reverence at all the good times they had at the Friday Afternoon Club, which they can't remember. So it was definitely a thing for a long time. But the hotel itself eventually fell into disrepair. We used to host our Rotary meetings there. And it's been kind of trucking along as an underperforming real estate asset for the last decade, if not two decades. So what's happened? Well, a developer has purchased it and the Rocky Mountain Tennis Center, where all the tennis courts are across from the creek. So this runs right through the creek. And that developer spent over $70 million on this property. And their plan is to completely redevelop it into student housing. So it's 15 acres of land. The development's going to be called The Standard at Boulder. And we're talking right now what they've forecasted is 936 beds. So about 1,000 students are going to live in this zone and be right next to CU, right on the creek, and potentially alleviate some of the incredible need for housing here in the city of Boulder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, how do you think about that, at least from, I guess, a rental perspective, and then also it does alleviate that there's already a lack of housing in Boulder for renters and for buyers, so I guess shifting that population of student renters that are also sharing in the single-family home space into a dedicated complexes should, I think, make it a little bit easier. I don't think it's going to change prices drastically or anything there, but it might open up a little bit of selection.
Well, the rental market's even more opaque than the market to buy or sell.
Mm-hmm.
And because we also represent real estate investors who have purchased condos and houses for a variety of reasons, including the rental market as income properties, we know quite a bit about this topic. And it's the way I think about it is the student segmentation of the market is very different than adults that are not students. And those adults also fall into different categories. There's a lot of young professionals that would like to live in Boulder, but the nightlife and the social scene for single people is way better in Denver. So they're usually coupled up by the time they want to move to Boulder and usually pretty successful in order to be able to afford Boulder. Or they're downsizing into something really small. It's almost like being in Manhattan, although not even close to the size of the broom closets you'll rent in Manhattan for insane amounts of money. But it's similar in its nature, that there aren't a lot of options. And the people that are young professionals that are out of school don't want to live in student zones. So because the students are, well, immature and tend to party and tend to make a lot of noise. And they also bring things like property crime. Mm-hmm. It's petty stuff, like angry young men that didn't get what they wanted that evening from their experience and decide to go break mirrors on the way home.
Yeah.
Right? Like they're walking on cars that are parked on the street because they just want to show how cool they are and how they don't care. And they're 18 to 21. And, you know, we were 18 to 21 at one point too in our lives. And so we could speak from firsthand experience how dumb I was between 18 and 21. So that's a distinction in the marketplace, is the market that caters to students and the market that caters to non-students. And then within the non-student zone, there are young professionals and families. There are people relocating here. And there's also a very high end of the market, which will pay an incredible premium to be downtown in turnkey properties. So there's market segmentation when it comes to rentals too. Mm-hmm. And even with the student population, there's grad students and then there's undergrads. And there's a party side of town over on the hillside. And then on the east side of the city, it's far less party central and you're more likely to get serious students.
That's right.
That are studying serious things. And you know this after being a landlord. It's easy to see these patterns after you've been a landlord for 20 years in the city of Boulder.
Yeah.
So With that said, this is clearly aimed right at students, and it's right where students should want to be. They're right next to CU's campus. It's sad that we will lose a amenity that appealed to more than just students, but this was underutilized. We have a bunch of new hotels coming, and so I don't particularly feel some sadness about the Millennium disappearing, but I do realize that parking is going to get even tougher, and the redevelopment or the new development for a tennis club up in Gun Barrel is a whole nother topic that has really agitated a number of residents who live in the neighborhoods that are now in very close proximity to where they're trying to build this tennis club. And they are protesting left, right, and center over it because they don't like it where they're trying to build it. So with that said, that's the new Millennium. It's almost 1,000 beds that are going to magically appear in about 2 years. That zone is going to be construction central, just like a lot of Boulder.
Yeah, it's going to be crazy. Interesting. I didn't realize the Millennium was that hotel that I drive past coming into Boulder. But it is kind of a cool building, so I hope they at least have some sort of neat architecture with this new development.
I hope so, too. We published this week a short video of the new library under construction. And even though the neighborhood was not in favor of that library because of the potential magnet it represents to the homeless population and the associated property crime issues and harassment issues for residents from homeless people, what's actually being built is really pretty. Mm-hmm. It's really unique. Yeah. I think when the original Boulder Public Library was built, it also was so unique with that giant glass atrium.
Yeah.
This takes it to another level. It is really a unique and interesting building. And I'm excited it's right down the street from our office. But at the same time, I also felt the neighborhood concern. And they were right to be concerned. And at this point, there's nothing that can change about that. I'm cautiously optimistic. But everything else, Hamish, all the other major developments that have occurred since I moved to Boulder in 2000, none of them, off the top of my head anyway, I get excited about.
Yeah.
They're all kind of ugly buildings.
Yeah. And it is, back to the North Boulder Library. It's pretty, and we keep a glimpse of the Flatiron view from the office, or from the office street. So,
you can see the Flatiron silver lining right above, and I think that's going to be a living roof. I think it's going to be a grass roof. But let's go back to the Millennium, and it's very similar to that house on 13th Street, which somebody built to maximize bedrooms and square footage. Well, these developers have a mandate to make money for their investors. So they're going to maximize bedrooms and square footage because that's going to maximize rent.
Mm-hmm.
They're also going to maximize four-unit apartments because young people don't want to live in isolation for the most part. They want to have roommates and play together and party together and study together. So those units that are going to sell for a premium or rent for a premium.
Yeah.
And that means you're going to have a really ugly big box down there, or multiple ugly big boxes, because that's what they're trying to do. And it's sort of like the design that is supposed to be aesthetically pleasing comes after the primary function, which is maximize money for the developer. And I wish we had what existed on Nantucket when I was involved in real estate on Nantucket, which is basically a design review committee. And they were more focused on things like you can't have this many dormers. It looks out of place for the neighborhood. And they're very focused on keeping everything looking historic. But you could also have a design review committee that's just like, this is just an ugly building.
Mm-hmm.
And we're arbitrarily going to decide that we're not going to approve this. You have to come up with something more visually interesting. We're not allowing our city to just turn into this ugliness. But I'm not on city council, nor can I run. But this would be my platform, is forget about this giant, insane book of code, and let's move to an arbitrary design review committee comprised of two or three architects, two or three residents that are part of our community, throw a CU student on there, and they all have to vote, and it has to be like 70-30 or 70%, like there has to be a super majority to approve projects. That's what and they could send feedback back to the architect. And the primary goal is to make not just functional buildings, but aesthetically pleasing architecture.
I want to feel something when I see the building, you know, even if it's a little something, but...
Well, anything but disgust, which is what I feel with a lot of new construction.
And boredom.
All right.
Okay.
Speaking of development, Boulder has for many decades loved one of our last remaining dive bars. It's called the Dark Horse. And this is our second topic du jour. of this particular segment on the news, the Dark Horse is now threatened by development. And if you've ever been in the Dark Horse, it truly is a dive. It's sticky.
It is.
It's greasy. The food that comes out of the kitchen. Personally, I don't think the drinks are that inexpensive for the, I don't know, unattractive place that it is. But it has character, right? It's been around a long time. There have been lots and lots of community events. I think the Cruiser Club used to host big wheel races inside the Dark Horse. Like, there's all this stuff that the Dark Horse has been part of for a really long time. So people have a fondness for this building and this business. But too bad the Dark Horse didn't buy the lot, because it's owned by the Williams family, also the same family that developed Williams Village, or sold Williams Village to a developer. And guess what? They want money. And they
color me surprised.
The money in developing this particular parcel and the parcels adjacent to the Dark Horse is massive. So they have proposed a pretty significant development. Hamish, do you have that in front of you?
Do you
want to walk through what this is?
Yep.
Okay. All right. Let me see if I can find it. Hold on. I have an article about it somewhere.
While you're searching, I'm going to urge the local listeners to go check out the Dark Horse if you haven't already. It's somewhat of a landmark, and it's been around for so long, I think around 50 years, that the interior has been just adorned with a million trinkets. I mean, you can sit there and be in the same position in the bar the whole night and see something new anywhere you look. It's just a really unique place to be.
Yeah. That's right. It's unique, and you should go before it's gone. Mm-hmm. But honestly, my personal opinion is it's probably not worth saving. However, what they're talking about building is not exactly exciting either.
Yeah.
And so this is what they're talking about building. 610 residential units divided between market rate and student apartments. 77,000 square feet of commercial, with more than 7,000 intended for restaurants. A 76,000 square foot hotel, two parking structures, and underground space for nearly 800 vehicles.
Jeez.
And this is from BizWest, and they are quoting the one of the developers, actually the investor, Morgan Creek, who says, Andy Bush says, quote, "It's really an old 70s shopping center that's 100% paved and impervious." And while he acknowledges the importance of the Dark Horse, I guess I should say they acknowledge the importance of the Dark Horse to the CU community, he, along with other redevelopment project representatives, I'm reading the article, so it is a he, said the goal is to find a place for the beloved burger and beer joint elsewhere on the site. I got to tell you, that's not Bush's goal.
No.
The goal for Morgan Creek is to make money. They don't care about Dark Horse 2.0, but they know the community does. So they are kowtowing to what the community says it wants and is emotional about. But really, they're going to build a ton of housing, 285 student housing units, 325 non-student housing units. There's no mention of whether these are rentals or are homes you can buy. But I can assure you, given how the city has not protected homeowners and the rights to buy, that it's almost certainly all 100% rental. And this is something, by the way, Fort Collins does a better job of. A lot of their new development in apartments are purchasable. The American dream is not to enrich your corporate landlord, unfortunately. But that is what's being built here, is your corporate landlord's housing for you. As a good student debtor or a good working worker, that's what working class housing is likely what they're going to build. Probably not high-end housing. It's right next to the highway.
Yeah.
The west side will have great views of the Flatirons. And it is right next to CU. It's a great spot for it. But it's development that is very likely to be more of maximizing the square footage and making it almost so generic that it's just sad to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm excited for the green space, at least on the architect's renderings. I think the criticism's correct in that it is pretty much kind of a concrete plaza at this point. I remember shooting some B-roll here for a listing we had a couple years back, and it's hard to make it look amazing, so at least from a marketing perspective, you know, a new build will look a little bit better. Yeah.
Look, the Dark Horse is a rundown dive bar. There's no getting around it. We're emotional about it. The highest and best use is probably more housing. I don't like the idea of 800 parking spaces or more than 800 people, but 1,500 people coming in and out of this space. The traffic is going to be really challenging to manage. But it also, I really wish that we could inspire better design. Unlike Boulder Junction, you know, with metal trees. I mean, it's so infuriating and it's frustrating. And you know what I also find really funny? When people call me a development shill. Like, I'm really excited to see more development because I'm in real estate. And the opposite could be true. I really wish our community would prioritize design and would come up with systems that didn't make development more difficult, take away some of the regulations, but insist on design that is compelling.
Yeah, let's tweak our current status quo. And I think you're completely right in the criticism of a corporate landlord. I mean, that's for a long time now been a proper criticism, and seeing it continue, especially in Boulder, which generally purports to be a little bit more progressive, it's just a bit of a bad taste type of thing to see.
The American dream is not to pay off your landlord's mortgage.
Yes.
The American dream is to own a home of your own. That sounds great. I'm very inspired by that. You own your own home, take care of your family in that home if you choose to have one, raise them if you choose to have a family, and build wealth. Use that home as a platform for security. Invest in that home over time, invest in your community over time, and ultimately watch that mortgage disappear over two or three decades. And that is the beauty of real estate ownership in our country and becoming a member of our community. And it's really hard for people that are renting and just here short term to experience that. And it's even harder if you have no opportunity to buy. You're basically, your choices are corporate landlord or not, and the corporate landlord's priority is 100% to maximize their rental return, big their time. Income from their investment. It's not to give you a great place to live, and it's certainly not to care about the dark horse.
Yeah. Dark horse is like, oh, geez, there's people that care about this dinky old bar. Fine, I'll make a statement.
I like the the developer's comment. I mean, and I like the dark horse, but I get the Williams family's position. Yeah. They're cashing out, baby. That's why they built Willville.
Money's money. Oh, yeah. All right. Final.
Ready for the last topic? Yeah,
let's hit it.
All right. Let's talk about Coach Prime. So a year ago, I wrote a, I would think, fairly well-researched and considered article, but tongue-in-cheek, about what Coach Prime should buy. Because it was just announced he was coming here. And I thought, all right, well, he's coming here. He's got a large family. He's got quite an exotic car collection. He cares about his family. He hosts events. He cares about our community. And so I came up with five very important criteria Coach Prime should seek in a new home. And that is on the House Einstein Fresh Listings newsletter from December of last year. December 2022, not December the month ago.
Should I link it in?
And I don't think you can. I think you have to subscribe because in order to get the newsletter, it's free to subscribe, and you can get the what our rules are, or what we would have advised Coach Prime to do if he was shopping, and we even included a couple of houses that he should think about. But he did not get the newsletter, and he did not hire us, and he bought the wrong house. And what he the reason he bought the wrong house, frankly, is because that house is so far out of town that he has a horrible commute, and the commute is the number one factor for happiness. And unlike a lot of our jobs where we can work remotely in the city of Boulder, you can't do that if you're coaching a bunch of 18-year-old football players. You need to be on site pretty much every day. Mm-hmm. You can't call it in. And that means he really needs to be within 15 minutes. And he didn't buy something within 15 minutes. But I think what he bought was mostly turnkey, although somewhat traditional. Privacy and security, it totally makes sense because it has very little around it. And I don't think it's a gated community, but almost nobody knows where that house is. And I'm not going to reveal the address here. It has lots of land. You can see the foothills. It feels like you're in Colorado, but it has a really crappy commute. And that was a failure on the number one thing for happiness. And this week in the news, Dion's sons... haven't somehow, I guess they put together a a piece of social media content.
Yeah, I'm not entirely clear on this.
I saw it and I ignored it because it wasn't. I don't really need to see these guys looking at another house. I probably should have watched it because it turns out they were looking at a house in Golden, and I have to be careful here. So this is the news. Supposedly the boys were gifting a house to their dad. Okay, it turned out to not be the case. The home is not under contract. According to the listing agent, you could still buy this house. I have to be careful talking about this because the house, even though you can find the address if you do your research, I can't talk about active listings because of the rules that govern our industry, because of the MLS rules, because of realtor rules. I can't publicly talk about active listings. I could talk about it in the Fresh Listings monthly newsletter because that's private, but this podcast is definitely not private. Mm-hmm. But what I will talk about are some reasons why this is yet another horrible choice for Dion.
I will dunk on
and
this.
And why he's right to not buy this house. First, the price is a little on the high end for Golden, 7.7. I mean, you're getting a huge house, right? It's got the square footage.
Undoubtedly.
It's got the bedroom count. It's got the garage mahal, which he really wants for the toys. But it's a half-hour drive to Folsom Field. That means you're in the car for an hour a day. And during that hour, you're also cruising along Highway 93, which, if he doesn't know, on a windy day, even if it's not snowing in winter, can turn into a blizzard, a ground blizzard. Mm-hmm. It shuts down in the winter. This is not a good choice. So,
gorgeous summer drive.
Coach, don't listen to your boys. They know not what they do. They have no idea when it comes to house selection. If you work from home, sure. You know, giant house, bedroom count, very pretty, but because you don't work from home, you need to be within 15 minutes. So dial it back, sell the house up north, buy something within 15 minutes. And if you need the tips on what to buy, it's in December 2022's House Einstein Fresh Listings newsletter.
Yeah. I off podcast, there's a property that's on that newsletter that I think we might want to bring back or discuss, but it's an interesting case.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anything else about Coach Prime? What would you look for if you were coach?
Nothing necessarily. I mean, even just being up slightly in the foothills would be a little better. Honestly, you'd get a little bit more privacy and a little bit for, you know, it's not a 15 minutes directly, but even 20 and just still being in Boulder, I think would be more ideal.
Well, this is probably better than where he is right now.
Mm-hmm.
I will give the boys that.
It certainly that got the dazzle.
Well, Shiloh and Shador are probably easily swayed by dazzle, as young men are,
yeah,
as I was at that age. But it is closer to the airport in Broomfield, where very likely
good point.
Coach Prime flies in and out of. I don't think he's going all the way to DIA. He's going to fly private.
Yeah.
And it's 30 minutes. It's a little closer than where they are now, but it's still too far. So where he should be looking is East Boulder County. He should also be looking in – there are some unique parcels that occasionally pop up southeast of town. He could even go into the foothills where I live of outside the city, Sunshine Canyon, Four Mile Canyon, even up into Sugarloaf, although it's a little icy, but your drive is closer to 20 minutes. And how often are you flying out of here anyway? Do you care about the Broomfield Airport? But really, the stuff that is east of the city, and there's a few pocket neighborhoods with some very high-end houses that he might want to look at. And I guess it would really depend on his level of security need, because if you own the house and it's not in a subdivision, you can put some pretty high-end security, gates and so forth. But if it's in a subdivision with an association, you may not actually be able to put in security gates and that sort of stuff. So that could be a factor. But I really hope he does not buy this house.
There's better out there. Pretty much, just succinctly, there's better out there, a better fit. So,
yeah,
as our unofficial agents, you know,
we're like it's a football game and we're commenting on the game, but we're not in the game.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much, yeah, exactly.
We just happen to know a lot about the game, specifically to this area. And I really, really hope he's getting better advice
from whoever is
people that actually take fiduciary responsibility seriously, that are in line with our mission, help people make smart real estate decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, I want to add one more piece. Right, if you're my client and I tell you this is a bad idea, I'll say it once, I'll tell you the property is a bad idea once. I'll probably say it twice because I really feel better about myself if I say it twice. But I usually don't say it a third time that you're making a bad decision because people get offended. I only have one client who might be listening to this podcast who has asked me to tell him 5 or 6 times when he's making a bad decision. And I'm happy to comply with that if you specifically request it. But I don't want to be the person that, you know, takes a hammer to your dreams on a home that you and your partner – family are excited about, and I tell you all everything wrong with it. I would like you to go in with eyes wide open, but I don't want to just keep hammering on that because it feels like
you're not going to.
I'm disrespectful.
Keep raining on a parade. Yeah, exactly. So,
okay, that's the news segment.
That's that.
Let's talk about whether you should hire your friend as a real estate agent, and this is one of the most common problems I see in real estate transactions, and I've seen over the last 20 years. People choose to hire their friends because their friend is somebody they like, because their friend seems like they have their best interest in mind, and also because they have no ability to see the performance difference between agents. It's in the absence of performance metrics, buyers and sellers go with brand and they go with people they trust. That's it. Mm-hmm. And so they choose these agents, unfortunately, that often don't do a lot of transactions, often are not even in the market that the buyer or seller would like to focus on. So we have one of these deals in our team, and the agent that's on the House Einstein team has been approached by a buyer who wants to buy in an area that our agent focuses in. The problem is they've already started working with an agent that's their friend. And their friend is totally out of market. They don't understand the market here, and they don't do a lot of transactions on top of that. Like, you can learn the market, but you can't really learn the business if you only do a couple of transactions a year, or you're new to the business. If you haven't been doing it very long, you also can't learn the business. So why do people hire their friends? Well, you know, they trust their friends. It strengthens those friendships. It's possible those people are well qualified. And maybe, just maybe, this agent friend will be more comfortable telling you when you're being unreasonable. Maybe.
Maybe.
Depending on the nature of the friendship.
Yeah, definitely dynamic dependent, right?
100%. Yeah. But here's the problem, Hamish. The agent that's been hired, that's the friend,
they may
not be competent.
No.
They're friendly. Well, they're your friend. Yeah. Not your friendly agent. They're your friend. They may be completely incompetent in what they're doing. And that could also damage your friendship, that you were friends, and because they so messed this up, you will never be friends with them again. They didn't tell you what they should have told you about due diligence with the mm-hmm. home, maybe about its problems that are often visible and obvious to people that know what to look for. And the biggest problem, the biggest con, is that the agent is, especially the part-timer that does a few transactions a year, is so motivated to close that they're blind to everything else. And this is one of those hidden secrets of real estate, that the buy-side agent, even though they have signed a buyer agency that says they represent the exclusive interests of the buyer, and that's here in Colorado, let me add that to any people listening outside of Colorado, even though they've signed that, their performance incentive is to close this deal. And it's sort of like the old joke, like when the patient asks the doctor, "Do I really need this procedure?" And the doctor's like, "I got a boat to pay for." Yeah, you need this procedure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I got 2 kids going to college in a few years. You need this procedure. So that is often, that conflict of interest is often very present for agents that are not at the top of the business. The agents that are doing high volume, and not their brokerage, they themselves are doing higher volume, that are well established and successful, are not hand to mouth. They are not worried about one transaction. And hopefully they also have the character and integrity to tell you when you're making a mistake. Unlike your friend that does 2 or 3 deals a year and just wants to get this deal done,
yeah,
they won't tell you those things. Their motivations are very different. And this is also why it's so critical to interview multiple agents.
You're reading my mind. It is one of the questions on our questions to interview an agent with is, you know, when have you said no to a client and why? And it brings up the whole thing, right? Is this agent just completely incentivized by the check at close?
So what Hamish is referring to is our list of questions for interviewing real estate agents. We have our own list, what we share publicly. Maybe we could put a link to it, Hamish, in the podcast notes.
Absolutely.
But it is something that I can't emphasize enough. Most people start their home buying experience by looking at houses and trying to understand the market, and they put so little time into choosing who actually represents them. And it's unfortunate, because the difference between an agent who's experienced and professional and has integrity and an agent who does not have those things is night and day, and will cost you not tens but potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars. And the mistakes I see every year are just astounding. Mm-hmm. I'm now 20 years into this industry, and it just blows my mind. And I wish it was harder to get a license, but at the same time, those bad agents are a distinction between us, and we can position ourselves against those bad agents and remind people about our mission. Our mission is to help you make a smarter real estate decision. It is in our logos. It is mm-hmm. in our taglines. It's written on the walls of our windows at the office. I talk about it all the time, because it is such a key distinction between what we do at House Einstein and what other agents may do at these other brokerages. And ask what the mission is of your brokerage when you're shopping agents, or if you're listening to this and you actually share our values, ask what, if you can even remember the mission of your brokerage.
Yeah.
Because I suspect it's like the Williams family and the Dark Horse.
Money.
The mission is to make money.
Hell yeah.
Okay. All right. So this is our last segment. Tell me something I don't know. Actually, it's not our last segment. I lied. One more segment after that. This is our second to last segment. Tell me something I don't know. How to fire your realtor. Well, there's a right way and there's a wrong way to fire your realtor. So let's talk about two stages of real estate relationship. The first stage is before you sign an exclusive agreement for their representation. Mm-hmm. And if they are here in Colorado, that usually occurs within the first couple of meetings. And some of these agents are going to slap that document in front of you the first meeting. Do not sign it.
Yeah.
You want to get to know them and make sure they're a good fit for
Shop
you.
Shop around.
And they really should want to, and they really should make sure you're a good fit for them, because they, if they're smart, they don't want to sign themselves up to serve a buyer who really is unrealistic and has no real potential of buying.
Or just a bad personality fit even, you know?
Or a disconnect when it comes to personality. They don't get along. Some people don't like me. I think most people do. I try to be a good listener, try to be a nice human. But every couple of years, I get somebody that wants to work with us initially, and then later we realize this: we've got, like, there's a disrespect going on, mm-hmm. not from me, but from them. And I'm like, you're disrespectful to my colleagues, you're disrespectful to the other people involved in the transaction process, and you're rude to me. Every once in a while, I have to fire clients because of that.
But this is the other
agents,
way around.
Sorry.
Yeah.
But this is the other way around, because it's very easy for the agent to fire you. It's actually much more difficult for you as a buyer or seller to fire your agent after you've signed that exclusive agreement. There's one more piece, and this is not legal advice. Let me reemphasize that. Mm. But there is one more piece, and that is there's a concept of procuring cause. And procuring cause alone potentially could make a buyer liable for a commission. And therefore, be careful, even without a buyer agency agreement, going to look at houses with people. I tell my potential clients that let's go look at some houses, we'll get to know each other, and if you decide we're not a good fit, that's fine. You can go choose another agent to work with. I don't have a problem with that. And that's true. I would never sue a client for procuring cause. Mm-hmm. This is procuring cause for the transaction. And in other states, agents have been successful suing their own potential prospective client who they showed a house to, that they were the procuring cause of the transaction, and therefore the buyer owes them a commission. So be really, really careful. This is a thing. It's not common. It's really bad business practice suing your clients, it is possible. So the first phase is the get to know your agent phase. Then if they're good, they're going to ask you for a buyer agency agreement, because they want to protect their time, as also clarify the relationships that exist under the buyer agency. So how do you fire this person is the question. Let's say you started to go out and look at homes with them, and it's clear that...
And we're under a buyer agency, right?
Nope, not yet. This is the first phase. Before the buyer agency. This is when it's easy to fire them.
Okay.
And it's clear they don't know the neighborhoods. They don't point out things wrong with the house. Every house is a good house for you to buy, and here are all the great things about this house. They don't have any knowledge about the market other than what they've read at the broad level. They can't speak to the neighborhoods. That sort of information, if they can't break it down for you what their services are besides opening a door, mm-hmm. that's a good time for you to part ways. And for frame of reference, our services are not primarily focused on we find you the house, because that's a lie. People don't, it's rare when the agent finds the house. Mm-hmm. Much more commonly, online systems find the house. We help you negotiate the best possible deal. And then once you're under contract, help you do thorough and complete due diligence before closing, protecting your earnest money. That's our mission. And I've said it so many times, I could say it in my sleep. That's what we do. But other agents may just open doors. And often that is the case, having been the listing agent, watching some of these people show up at our listings that have no knowledge of the local market, don't know the comps, and then walk around with the buyer and everything is sunshine and rainbows. They're acting like the listing agent.
Yeah.
Really weird.
Convenient, but weird.
So you want to evaluate your... during this honeymoon phase, before you've signed the buyer agency, is this person responsive? Are they available? Do they have systems for when they go on vacation? Are they a full-time or part-time agent? How's their communication and how's their listening? Are they actually listening to what you care about? Or are they all ego and pompous behavior and tell you how smart and great they are? Are they the number one real estate agent for Boulder for the last 300 years? If they're proclaiming that sort of nonsense, they're probably not a great agent.
Yeah.
So how do you fire them? Well, because you're not under buyer agency, you tell them, you know, it's been nice working with you. We're going to move in a different direction. We feel like these are the reasons why, and that's it. And if they say, hey, can we at least talk about this? Maybe you give them the courtesy of that conversation, but you do so with constructive feedback maybe in mind, but don't expect to be swayed to be back. And they should not expect to be swayed to be back, mm-hmm. right? This is already the fired moment. Now, you don't have to go from 0 to 100. There are mid-zones where you can say, look, what I'm really looking for in an agent is somebody who does these things. And then you can evaluate them on how they do those things. You can encourage growth. But you're paying sometimes millions of dollars, and you should get the top representation for the money you're spending. And yes, the money comes from the buy side. So this is money you are spending. Mm-hmm. But once you're under buyer agency, your options to fire them are radically reduced. Yeah. And frankly, they have to be not performing to the contract, or they have to agree to let you out of the buyer agency agreement. And this is specific to the state of Colorado, and you better be carefully tracking how they're not performing. Like, you want to do a showing on a Saturday and they're off in Mexico or Bali or whatever, having a good time, and there's no coverage. Well, that's a really good reason to fire an agent.
And very clear cut too. Easy example.
They hid due diligence. Mm-hmm. Right? We have a client right now that is under buyer agency with us. They fired. We did a listing takeover. We took over this business from the other agent that they were working with. And the other agent did a horrible job on negotiation and didn't give proper credence to the buyer's concerns over environmental issues and health issues. And when the listing agent was hiding things, the buyer got the impression the buyer's agent was also hiding things because they really wanted the deal to close. Mm-hmm. And that's not atypical for an agent that doesn't share your values and integrity and character and care about the mission to help you make a smarter decision like we do. So be careful with who you choose. But once you're under buyer agency, you have to demonstrate that they have somehow not lived up to the terms. So read your buyer agency agreement carefully. And we have had situations where the buyer's agent refused and said, absolutely not, I represent you, I've been performing. And then a handy little letter from an attorney with the evidence of how you haven't been performing, sent to this agent and their employing broker, usually stops any of that behavior. Because the employing broker's job, which is my job at House Einstein with the other agents, is to talk sense into the agent that's causing this problem. Mm-hmm. So Hamish, if you came to me and you don't do my understanding, Hamish does not do regular residential brokerage. But let's say you were an agent and you were working with a buyer and you were in this circumstance and I suddenly got a letter from an attorney that said, we are terminating this agreement due to non-performance. And furthermore, your agent is saying they refuse to let it go and we are disputing this and we're potentially going to end up in court. And I would call you and be like, Hamish.
Oh my God.
This is not worth one. For, you are making a huge, like legally, you might be right and you may have an argument for how they are in violation of their buyer agency agreement. You cannot work with somebody that is threatening to sue you. And you either have one chance to fix this or you need to let them mm-hmm. go. And maybe letting them go is as you live out the length of the agreement, however you settle this, you settle it, but you're not going to go sue your client. This is a horrible idea if you want to be a real estate agent.
And at that point, I mean, I've gotten clear attorney language saying that they don't want to work with me. I'm going to let that go. Why would I fight to that? You know, they've already put their position out there. So,
well, and our brokerage is not going to fund your legal fees.
Yeah.
So I think you need to, and you're going to destroy your reputation. This person's going to tell 100 people what a jerk you are.
Yeah, the whole thing.
And that's the last thing you want.
Yeah.
You work so hard to build a reputation for integrity and trust and service in this industry, and you can so easily destroy it by being dumb. And this is being dumb. Let go of it. Let the negative energy flow.
And maybe learn something.
Down the creek. And learn something. Like, you clearly didn't communicate expectations with these people and meet them. They had expectations you were unable to meet. Let them go and learn from the experience.
Yep. We didn't cover the wrong way, but that is definitely the correct way.
Ghost them. Let's talk about the wrong way. Don't ghost them. Do not ghost them. Do not just start working with somebody else and not tell them that you've chosen to work with somebody else.
That creates a whole mess.
Whatever you do,
do
not buy the house they showed you with another agent without having clarified working relationships and establishing why they're getting fired. You potentially open the door to being sued. Mm-hmm. And your agent, the new agent, should tell you about this because you could be liable for a double commission.
Yeah. Congrats. Here's your new home. You owe 2 commissions.
The other wrong way to not to fire your agent is to keep looking at houses with this person, right? And I've been
it's
on
like
the receiving end
quit.
Of this. This is a person that used to be a friend. And she's very top of mind because I recently interacted with her. And this person I showed this person real estate for about a 2-year period. And because they were friends, I never put them under buyer agency. We just looked at real estate. And then for whatever reason, she ghosted out about 2 years into the process. And a year later, she bought a house with somebody that was some other agent. And she never called me. She never asked for a showing. She never told me where we weren't meeting eye to eye. She just started working with somebody else. And she had the legal right to do so, but it was incredibly disrespectful of all the time and effort I'd already put in. And I don't know what happened. I'm not sure what her reasons were, but I sure would have liked to have heard them. Even if it was a one-way email saying, look, we're friends, so I'm going to give you some tough talk.
Right.
Here's how you're not meeting expectations. But I have no idea what happened. And I feel, so this is so rare, right? But this is the wrong way to fire someone because it's very disrespectful of their time. And that's the most important and precious thing each of us have on this planet is our time. And even though commission salespeople are commission salespeople, I really believe in treating every human being respectfully. And asking them to show you homes for a 2-year period, ghosting out for a 12-month period, and then going to buy something without even calling them after they've already invested 2 years with you is very disrespectful.
Yeah.
This is not a friend. That's why I said this person used to be a friend. This is not a friend.
Jeez, I'm sorry you have that personal anecdote.
It's almost never happens to me, but you know, growing up is getting tougher and realizing you make mistakes. And one of the mistakes I have made is in not just this relationship, but others, is when people, it's an Oprah thing. When people show you who they are, believe them the first time. And don't let your values of who you want them to be cloud your judgment of who they really are. Don't believe what they say, believe what they do. And when they show you who they are, believe them the first time they do this behavior that is, there's no way around it, is disrespectful.
Yeah.
So it can be the context of a romantic relationship or a professional relationship. It's the same principle.
Well, that's the wrong way.
That's the wrong way to fire somebody.
Okay.
And we talked about the right way, and now we've talked about the wrong way. So this last topic is very top of mind because it is something that you probably haven't heard anywhere else, and it is a second or third order effect from the rapid appreciation of Colorado real estate across the state, but primarily on the Front Range and in the resort towns. And that is, those elevated real estate values also are affecting all sorts of property that is not on the radar of most people. So there's lots and lots of very small parcels of land owned by individual landowners that don't have a structure on them, or maybe they have a hunting cabin, but they're not really buildable lots. And they have historically been taxed at very, very low levels because they have such low value. Well, the algorithms that price these properties for assessment purposes, they have spit out very large values. And I'll give you an example. There's a neighbor very close to me whose home burned down in the 4 Mile fire, and the home was never rebuilt. I don't think it's still even a buildable lot, although maybe it is, but the old home looks like it was built without a permit. It looks totally sketch. 70s era construction where people were just putting up houses before the rules came down on needing 35 acres and all the rest to develop a buildable lot.
Shoehorning something in, right?
And so the taxes for these mountain properties without... So a home was never rebuilt. And this is one of many pieces of vacant land. But I looked up the increases of some of the vacant land around me, and the numbers have gone up 40 times from their 2022 tax assessment. That's not twice as much. That's 40 times higher valuations.
Yeah.
So what is that doing? How that eventually gets negotiated and spills out to an actual levied tax is still a mystery to me because of I can't believe it hasn't happened yet. We were just talking about this with land title. Like, there's all these taxes that are not actually the final number. It's still preliminary 2023 taxes, and it's the end of January, and we don't know. So back up. Taxes are paid in arrears, property taxes. Yep. And so you don't really know the final number until, you know, the tax assessor throws out, this is your number. You protest it. They say, tough luck. Good protest, but no. And you end up with a slight reduction to their assessed value, which is all done by a computer formula and not by a human until you protest. Mm-hmm. When you protest it, then a human looks at it. Well, guess what? There's all this land. A lot of it's not even of local people that's been owned for decades and valued very, very low that now has jumped up in value. So some of these people are going to see, I don't want to say 40x increases in their property tax bill, but it could be 10x, 12x. I don't really know the number for another month or whenever the county gets around to finalizing the tax number. And what's the consequence of this? Well, I think we're going to start seeing a lot more land sales. And we're also going to start seeing people trying to get the agricultural exemption from their land, because if they put some cows or chickens on it, or they grow some crops on it, turn it into pasture land, and they actually can produce the receipts, they have the potential to get the property reclassified as agriculture, which Colorado historically is an agriculture state. Agriculture is taxed at very, very, very low numbers. But the county is wise to this. So if you go and look at their documentation for how to create an ag exemption or an ag reduction in your tax assessment, it's not easy. Okay. They want to know that you've been doing this for 2 or 3 years.
That's what I was going to ask. And that
go online, go to Boulder County's website, go to the agricultural land determination, and go to their forms and questionnaires, and it's all asking about the last 3 years of use. Do you have documentation to show that you were able to generate income from this property that came from an agricultural source? Mm-hmm. So whether it's growing alpaca and having that, there's all sorts of stuff that's existed for a long time, but it's going to accelerate because of this huge increase in real estate values in the last couple of years.
Yeah, this is going to be a really interesting pushback. I mean, we got, I wouldn't say inundated, but plenty of requests last year for assisting with tax appeals from last year's assessment. So seeing kind of, it's tea leaves, right? They're not hard numbers yet, but kind of seeing the increase in certain land.
The assessment is not tea leaves, but how that spills out into a levied amount, given Tabor and given the legislature and the governor's attempts to reconcile this, because they know what's coming, which is massive, angry landowners. Yes. Politically active, angry landowners that saw their tax bill skyrocket. And so unintended consequences... higher volume of available listings, there will be more sales. There will also be a lot of people trying to convert their property into ag land. And this will likely come up in election season when people realize how much their taxes have gone up. And by the way, for individual renters who are smugly saying, good, stick it to the landlord. No, it's gonna get passed where on. The money, it's coming to you. The landlord's not here. The landlord's business is to make money, and they're not here to lose money by paying more taxes. They're going to jack the rent and 100% expect rents. So everyone is, there's all these charts all over the place that show how much cheaper it is to rent right now. That's going to go away. Rents are going to go up dramatically. That's my belief, based on limited supply here, not necessarily other markets where they can build 10,000 units practically overnight and there's hardly any regulation, but here where there's almost no available land and a regulatory, I don't know, obstacle that's almost one of the most difficult in the country to overcome, there's not going to be a sudden jack up in supply. Mm-hmm. So it's economics 101. Expect your rent to go up.
Well, interesting. So we're going to see like more inventory, but kind of more unique inventory, I suppose, at least in your use
case. Well, we're talking about land. Yeah, we're talking about land. We're talking about small parcels. And the due diligence for whether these are buildable lots, honestly, that's your first question. Is this a buildable lot? Mm-hmm. If it's not a buildable lot, which means it has a letter saying it's a buildable lot, so people could say build your dream home if it in their listing, but if it does not have a buildable lot determination letter from the building department, it is not a buildable lot. And maybe it meets the criteria of a buildable lot. It has 35 acres. You have a building site that's not on a ridgeline. The soil can pass a perk test for a septic. All of the things that we talk about with our buyers, if it can do all of those things, maybe it's a buildable lot and you should put an offer on it, but with a timeline that allows you to verify all these things. Because otherwise you're paying for a buildable lot that may not be. And the county has a whole process for issuing a buildable lot determination. There's a whole document you can get on their website, but there'll be lots of pieces of land popping up that are not buildable lots that have language that makes it sound like it's a buildable lot.
And as we learned on the last podcast, lots of land coming up for sale may not actually be by their sellers either. There's the case of fraud there too.
A whole nother level of due diligence, but let's assume it's a legitimate listing. Do not believe the listing agent when they say it's a buildable lot. Do not believe your agent if they are talking about it being a buildable lot. Because, hey, it says it in the listing agreement. Perfect spot for your dream home. Yeah, perfect spot if you own another 33 acres. Yep.
Same with the open space. Perfect spot
if there was...
There's your next...
If the soil allowed for a septic. Perfect spot if you could drill a well here. Yeah.
There's your next red flag. Buildable lots. Maybe.
It's an interesting one. For our red flag video series, it just requires... I'm not sure I'm that excited to do a
determination. Your eyes did not light up.
Red flag video. Yeah. No, it's sort of like, I love those deals, but I don't particularly want more land buyers because it's a deal that land buys are a lot of work and not a lot of money. And for it to be a lot of money, it has to be a property that is land that is expensive, like a $2 or $3 million lot to justify the work involved. So the same thing is true in the private equity world or in the venture capital world. The firm I used to work for in Denver, we focused on a market of private businesses that was just below the radar of private equity, most private equity players. And the reason we focused there is that the multiples were lower. And the due diligence required for a $10 million deal was the same as the due diligence required for a $100 million deal.
Right.
The volume of capital going in doesn't dictate the due diligence. So why would you do deals at the smaller end? This is why the multiples are different. And I'm not really interested in representing buyers of land that want to spend $50 or $100 or even $300,000. It's too small of a deal to justify the intense level of due diligence and support necessary, unless this buyer wants to pay me separately, which would be more than the 2.8% commission to justify the amount of time it takes and research it takes and the low probability of success. Mm-hmm. It's like the old Venn diagram, probability of success, compensation. This is like low compensation, low probability of success. I don't really want more of these deals.
You're like, no thanks. No red
Good
flag.
Luck. I know a lot, but I don't want to market more about this. I already know too much and I don't want to tell people that this is something I really want more of these people as clients. There's only so much Osmond to spread around on the toast.
Good point.
I guess that makes me butter in this example. Okay, that's it. If you made it this far, we deeply appreciate your listening to the House Einstein podcast. I'm Osmond with House Einstein. With me is Hamish Crabb. Our mission is to help you make a smarter real estate decision. If you are enjoying this podcast, if you've enjoyed this podcast, please like and subscribe, tell your friends. And if you're thinking about buying or selling real estate in the Front Range, anywhere between the South Denver suburbs all the way into Fort Collins, or you're looking at the mountain towns, the convenient and easily accessible mountain towns like Breckenridge. We also do work up in those locations. We'd be happy to represent you. You can find out more about House Einstein and our services at our website at houseeinstein.com. Thanks again for joining us.